Lewin, 1992, page 43. And that is not really in conflict with what I am calling it, meta-engineering. It is the investigation of the most general constraints on the processes that can lead to the creation and reproduction of designed things. But when he declares this a quest for laws, he feeds the anti-engineering prejudice, or you might call it physics envy, that distorts so much philosophical thinking about biology. Does anyone suppose that there are laws of nutrition? Laws of locomotion? There are all sorts of highly imperturbable boundary conditions on nutrition and locomotion, owing to fundamental laws of physics, and there are plenty of regularities, rules of thumb, trade-offs, and the like that are encountered by any nutritional or locomotive mechanisms. But these are not laws. They are like the highly robust regularities of automotive engineering. Consider the regularity that, ceteris paribus, ignition is accomplished only by or after the use of a key. There is a reason for this, of course, and it has to do with the perceived value of automobiles, their susceptibility to theft, the cost-effective but not foolproof options provided by pre-existing locksmith technology, and so forth. When one understands the myriad cost-benefit trade-offs of the design decisions that go into creating automobiles, one appreciates this regularity. It is not any kind of law. It is a regularity that tends to settle out of a complex set of competing desiderata, otherwise known as norms. These highly reliable norm-tracking generalizations are not laws of automotive engineering, nor are their biological counterparts laws of locomotion or nutrition. The location of the mouth at the bow, rather than at the stern end of the locomoting organism, ceteris paribus, there are exceptions, is a deep regularity. But why call it a law? We understand why it should be so, because we see what mouths, or locks and keys, are for, and why certain ways are the best ways of accomplishing those ends. Chapter 8. Biology is not just like engineering, it is engineering. It is the study of functional mechanisms, their design, construction, and operation. From this vantage point, we can explain the gradual birth of function and the concomitant birth of meaning or intentionality. Achievements that at first seem either literally miraculous, for example, the creation of recipe readers where none were before, or at least intrinsically mind-dependent, learning to play winning checkers, can be broken down into the ever smaller achievements of ever smaller and stupider mechanisms. We have now begun to pay close attention to the design process itself, not just its products, and this new research direction is deepening Darwin's dangerous idea, not overthrowing it. Chapter 9. The task of reverse engineering in biology is an exercise in figuring out what Mother Nature had in mind. This strategy, known as adaptationism, has been an amazingly powerful method, generating many spectacular leaps of inference that have been confirmed, along with some that have not, of course. The famous critique of adaptationism by Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin focuses attention on the suspicions people have harbored about adaptationism, but is largely misdirected. The applications of game theory in adaptationism have been particularly fruitful, but one must be cautious. There may be more hidden constraints than theorists often assume. Chapter 9. Searching for Quality. 1. The Power of Adaptationist Thinking. Naked as Nature Intended was a persuasive slogan of the early naturist movement. But nature's original intention was that the skin of all primates should be un-naked. Elaine Morgan, 1990, page 66. Judging a poem is like judging a pudding or a machine. One demands that it work. It is only because an artifact works that we infer the intention of an artificer. W. Wimsatt and M. Beardsley, 1954, page 4. If you know something about the design of an artifact, you can predict its behavior without worrying yourself about the underlying physics of its parts. Even small children can readily learn to manipulate such complicated objects as VCRs without having a clue as to how they work. They know just what will happen when they press a sequence of buttons because they know what is designed to happen. They are operating from what I call the design stance. The VCR repairer knows a great deal more about the design of the VCR and knows roughly how all the interior parts interact to produce both proper functioning and pathological functioning, but may also be quite oblivious of the underlying physics of the processes. Only the designers of the VCR had to understand the physics. They are the ones who must descend to what I call the physical stance in order to figure out what sorts of design revisions might enhance picture quality, or diminish wear and tear on the tape, or reduce the electricity consumption of the product. But when they engage in reverse engineering of some other manufacturer's VCR, for instance, they avail themselves not only of the physical stance, but also of what I call the intentional stance. They try to figure out what the designers had in mind. They treat the artifact under examination as a product of a process of reasoned design development, a series of choices among alternatives in which the decisions reached were those deemed best by the designers. Thinking about the postulated functions of the parts is making assumptions about the reasons for their presence. And this often permits one to make giant leaps of inference that finesse one's ignorance of the underlying physics, or the lower-level design elements of the object. Archaeologists and historians sometimes encounter artifacts whose meaning, whose function or purpose, is particularly obscure. It is instructive to look briefly at a few examples of such artifact hermeneutics to see how one reasons in such cases. The Antikythera mechanism, discovered in 1900 in a shipwreck, and dating from ancient Greece, is an astonishingly complex assembly of bronze gears. What was it for? Was it a clock? Was it the machinery for moving an automaton statue, like Vaucanson's marvels of the 18th century? It was, almost certainly, an orrery or a planetarium. And the proof is that it would be a good orrery. That is, calculations of the periods of rotation of its wheels led to an interpretation that would have made it an accurate, Ptolemaic representation of what was then known about the motions of the planets. The great architectural historian, Viollet-le-Duc, described an object called a Circe, used somehow in the construction of cathedral vaults. He hypothesized that it was a movable piece of staging used as a temporary support for incomplete web courses. But a later interpreter, John Fitchin, 1961, argued that this could not have been its function. For one thing, the Circe would not have been strong enough in its extended position, and its use would have created irregularities in the vault webbing which are not to be found. Fitchin's extended and elaborate argument concludes that the Circe was no more than an adjustable template, a conclusion he supports by coming up with a much more elegant and versatile solution to the problem of temporary support of web courses. The important feature in these arguments is the reliance on optimality considerations. It counts against the hypothesis that something is a cherry pitter, for instance, if it would have been a demonstrably inferior cherry pitter. Occasionally, an artifact loses its original function and takes on a new one. People buy old-fashioned sad irons not to iron their clothes with, but to use as bookends or doorstops. A handsome jam pot can become a pencil holder, and lobster traps get recycled as outdoor planters. The fact is that sat irons are much better as bookends than they are at ironing clothes when compared with the competition today. And a Deck 10 mainframe computer today makes a nifty heavy-duty anchor for a large boat mooring. No artifact is immune from such appropriation, and however clearly its original purpose may be read from its current form, its new purpose may be related to that original purpose by mere historic accident. The fellow who owned the obsolete mainframe needed an anchor badly, and opportunistically pressed it into service. The clues about such historical processes would be simply unreadable without assumptions about optimality of design. Consider the so-called dedicated word processor, the cheap, portable, glorified typewriter that uses disk storage and an electronic display screen, but can't be used as an all-purpose computer. If you open up one of these devices, you find it is governed by an all-purpose CPU, or central processing unit, such as an 8088 chip, a full-power computer vastly more powerful, swift, and versatile than the biggest computer Alan Turing ever saw, locked into menial service, performing a minuscule fraction of the tasks it could be harnessed to perform. Why is all this excess functionality found here? Martian reverse engineers might be baffled, but there is a simple historical explanation, of course. The genealogy of computer development gradually lowered costs of chip manufacture to the point where it was much cheaper to install a whole computer on a chip in a device than to build a special purpose control circuit. Notice that the explanation is historical, but also, inescapably, proceeds from the intentional stance. It became wise to design dedicated word processors this way when the cost-benefit analysis showed that this was the best, cheapest way to solve the problem. What is amazing is how powerful the intentional stance can be in reverse engineering, not only of human artifacts, but also of organisms. In Chapter 6, we talked about the role of practical reasoning, cost-benefit analysis in particular, in distinguishing the forced moves from what we might call the ad lib moves. And we saw how Mother Nature could be predicted to discover the forced moves again and again. The idea that we can impute such free-floating rationales to the mindless process of natural selection is dizzying. But there is no denying the fruits of the strategy. In chapters 7 and 8, we discussed how the engineering perspective informs research at every level from the molecules on up, and how this perspective always involves distinguishing the better from the worse, and the reasons Mother Nature has found for the distinction. The intentional stance is thus the crucial lever in all attempts to reconstruct the biological past. Did Archaeopteryx, the extinct bird-like creature that some have called a winged dinosaur, ever really get off the ground? Nothing could be more ephemeral, less likely to leave a fossil trace than a flight through the air. But if you do an engineering analysis of its claws, they turn out to be excellent adaptations for perching on branches, not for running. An analysis of the claw curvature, supplemented by aerodynamic analysis of the Archaeopteryx wing structure, makes it quite plain that the creature was well designed for flight. Fiducia, 1993. So it almost certainly flew, or had ancestors that flew. We mustn't forget the possibility of excess functionality persisting, like the computer in the word processor. The hypothesis that the Archaeopteryx flew has not yet been fully confirmed to every expert's satisfaction, but it suggests many further questions to address to the fossil record, and when those questions are pursued, either the evidence will mount in favor of the hypothesis or it won't. The hypothesis is testable. The lever of reverse engineering is not just for prying out secrets of history. It is even more spectacular as a predictor of unimagined secrets of the present. Why are there colors? Color coding is generally viewed as a recent engineering innovation, but it is not. Mother Nature discovered it much earlier. For the details, see the section on Why There Are Colors in Dennett, 1991A, pages 375 to 83. We know this thanks to lines of research opened up by Carl von Frisch, and as Richard Dawkins points out, von Frisch used a bold exercise in reverse engineering to make the initial move. Von Frisch, 1967, in defiance of the prestigious orthodoxy of von Hess, conclusively demonstrated color vision in fish and in honeybees by controlled experiments. He was driven to undertake those experiments by his refusal to believe that, for example, the colors of flowers were there for no reason, or simply to delight men's eyes. Dawkins, 1982, page 31. A similar inference led to the discovery of the endorphins, the morphine-like substances that we produce in our own bodies when we are put under enough stress or pain, creating the runner's high, for instance. The reasoning was the reverse of von Frisch's. Scientists found receptors in the brain that are highly specific for morphine, which has a powerful pain-killing effect. Reverse engineering insists that wherever there is a highly particular lock, there must be a highly particular key to fit it. Why are these receptors here? Mother Nature could not have foreseen the development of morphine. There must be some molecules produced internally under some conditions, the original keys that these locks were designed to receive. Seek a molecule that fits this receptor and is produced under circumstances in which a shot of morphine might be beneficial. Eureka! Endogenously created morphine, endorphin, was discovered. Even more devious Sherlock Holmesian leaps of deduction have been executed. Here, for instance, is a general mystery. Why do some genes change their pattern of expression depending on whether they are maternally or paternally inherited? Haig and Graham, 1991, page 1045. This phenomenon, in which the genome reading machinery pays more attention, in effect, to either the paternal text or the maternal text, is known as genomic imprinting. For a general account, see Haig, 1992, and has been confirmed to occur in special cases. What do the special cases have in common? Haig and Westaby, 1989, developed a model that purports to solve the general mystery by predicting that genomic imprinting would be found only in organisms in which females carry offspring by more than one male during their lifespan, and a system of parental care in which offspring receive most of their post-fertilization nutrients from one parent, usually the mother, and thus compete with offspring fathered by other males. In such circumstances, they reasoned, there should be a conflict between maternal and paternal genes. Paternal genes will tend to favor exploiting the mother's body as much as possible. But maternal genes would view this as almost suicidal. And the result should be that the relevant genes will, in effect, choose sides in a tug of war, and genomic imprinting will result. Haig and Graham, 1991, page 1046. See the model at work. There is a protein, insulin-like growth factor 2, IGF-2, which is, as its name suggests, a growth enhancer. Not surprisingly, the genetic recipes of many species order the creation of large quantities of IGF-2 during embryonic development. But like all functioning machines, IGF-2 needs the right supportive environment to do its work. And in this case, it needs helper molecules known as type 1 receptors. So far, our story is just like the endorphin story. We have a type of key, IGF-2, and a kind of lock, type 1 receptors, in which it fits and performs an obviously important role. But in mice, for instance, there is another kind of lock, type 2 receptors, in which it also fits. What are these secondary locks for? for nothing, apparently. They are descendants of molecules that in other species, toads, for instance, play a role in cells' garbage disposal systems. But this is not what they do when they bind to IGF-2 in mice. Then why are they there? Because they are ordered by the genetic recipe for making a mouse, of course. But here is the telltale twist. Whereas both the maternal and paternal contributions to the chromosome contain recipe instructions for making them, these instructions are preferentially expressed from the maternal chromosome. Why? To counteract the instruction in the recipe that calls for too much growth enhancer. The type 2 receptors are just there to soak up, to capture and degrade, all the excess growth enhancer that the paternal chromosome would pump into the fetus if it had its way. Since mice are a species in which females tend to mate with more than one male, males in effect compete to exploit the resources of each female, a competition from which females must protect themselves and their own genetic contributions. Haig and Westerby's model predicts that genes would evolve in mice to protect females from this exploitation, and this imprinting has been confirmed. Moreover, their model predicts that type 2 receptors shouldn't work this way in species in which genetic conflict of this sort can't arise. They shouldn't work this way in chickens because offspring can't influence how much yolk their eggs receive, so the tug of war can never get started. Sure enough, the type 2 receptors in chickens don't bind to IGF-2. Bertrand Russell once slyly described a certain form of illicit argument as having all the advantages of theft over honest toil, and one can sympathize with the hard-working molecular biologist who reacts with a certain envy when somebody like Haig swoops in saying, in effect, "Go look under that rock. I bet you'll find a treasure of the following shape." But that is what Haig was able to do. He predicted what Mother Nature's move would be in the 100-million-year game of mammal design. Of all the possible moves available, he saw that there was a good reason for this move, so this is what would be discovered. We can get a sense of the magnitude of the leap that such an inference takes by comparing it with a parallel leap that we can make in the game of life. Recall that one of the possible denizens of the life world is a universal Turing machine composed of trillions of pixels. Since a universal Turing machine can compute any computable function, it can play chess, simply by mimicking the program of any chess-playing computer you like. Suppose, then, that such an entity occupies the life plane, playing chess against itself, in the fashion of Samuel's computer playing checkers against itself. Looking at the configuration of dots that accomplishes this marvel would almost certainly be unilluminating to anyone who had no clue that a configuration with such powers could exist. But from the perspective of someone who had the hypothesis that this huge array of black dots was a chess-playing computer, enormously efficient ways of predicting the future of that configuration are made available. Consider the savings you could achieve. At first, you would be confronted by a screen on which trillions of pixels flash on and off. Since you know the single rule of life physics, you could laboriously calculate the behavior of each spot on the screen if you wanted, but it would take eons. As a first cost-cutting step, you could shift from thinking about individual pixels to thinking about gliders and eaters and still lifes and so forth. Whenever you saw a glider approaching an eater, you would just predict consumption in 4 generations without bothering with the pixel-level calculations. As a second step, you could move to thinking of the gliders as symbols on the tape of a gigantic Turing machine, and then, adopting this higher design stance towards the configuration, predict its future as a Turing machine. At this level, you would be hand-simulating the machine language of a computer program that plays chess. Still a tedious way of making predictions, but orders of magnitude more efficient than working out the physics. As a third and still more efficient step, you could ignore the details of the chess-playing program itself and just assume that, whatever they are good. That is, you could assume that the chess-playing program running on the Turing machine made of gliders and eaters played not just legal chess, but good legal chess. It had been well-designed. Perhaps it has designed itself, in the manner of Samuel's checkers program, to find the good moves. This permits you to shift to thinking about chessboard positions, possible chess moves, and the grounds for evaluating them, to shift to reasoning about reasons. Adopting the intentional stance towards the configuration, you could predict its future as a chess player performing intentional actions, making chess moves and trying to achieve checkmate. First, you would have to figure out the interpretation scheme that permits you to say which configurations of pixels count as which symbols. Which glider pattern spells out QXBCH, queen takes bishop, check, and the other symbols for chess moves. But then you could use the interpretation scheme to predict, for instance, that the next configuration to emerge from the galaxy would be such and such a glider stream. Say the symbols for RXQ, rook takes queen. There is risk involved, because the chess program being run on the Turing machine may be far from perfectly rational, and at a different level, debris may wander onto the scene and break the Turing machine configuration before it finishes the game. But if all goes well, as it normally will, if you have the right interpretation, you can astonish your friends by saying something like, I predict that the next stream of gliders to emerge in location L in this life galaxy will have the following pattern. A singleton, followed by a group of three, followed by another singleton. How on earth were you able to predict that that particular molecular pattern would appear then? In other words, real but potentially noisy patterns abound in such a configuration of the life world. There for the picking up, if only you are lucky or clever enough to hit on the right perspective. They are not visual patterns, but, you might say, intellectual patterns. Squinting or twisting your head in front of the computer screen is not apt to help, whereas posing fanciful interpretations, or what Quine would call analytical hypotheses, may uncover a gold mine. The opportunity confronting the observer of such a life world is analogous to the opportunity confronting the cryptographer, staring at a new patch of ciphertext, or the opportunity confronting the Martian peering through a telescope at the Super Bowl game. If the Martian hits on the intentional stance, otherwise known as folk psychology, as the right level to look for pattern, shapes will readily emerge through the noisy jostling of people particles and team molecules. The scale of compression when one adopts the intentional stance towards the two-dimensional chess-playing computer galaxy is stupendous. It is the difference between figuring out in your head what White's most likely, best chess move is versus calculating the state of a few trillion pixels through a few hundred thousand generations. But the scale of the savings is really no greater in the life world than in our own. Predicting that someone will duck if you throw a brick at him is easy from the intentional or folk psychological stance. It is, and will always be, intractable if you have to trace the photons from brick to eyeball, the neurotransmitters from optic nerve to motor nerve, and so forth. For such vast computational leverage, one might be prepared to pay quite a steep price in errors. But in fact, the intentional stance, used correctly, provides a description system that permits extremely reliable prediction of not only intelligent human behavior, but also the intelligent behavior of the process that designed organisms. All this would warm William Paley's heart. We can put the burden of proof on the skeptics with a simple challenge argument. If there weren't design in the biosphere, how come the intentional stance works? We can even get a rough measure of the design in the biosphere by comparing the cost of making predictions from the lowest level physical stance, which assumes no design, well, almost no design, depending on how we treat the evolution of universes, with the cost of making predictions from the higher stances, the design stance and the intentional stance. The added leverage of prediction, the diminution of uncertainty, the shrinkage of the huge search space to a few optimal or near-optimal paths is a measure of the design that is observable in the world. The biologist's name for this style of reasoning is adaptationism. It is defined by one of its most eminent critics as the growing tendency in evolutionary biology to reconstruct or predict evolutionary events by assuming that all characters are established in evolution by direct natural selection of the most adapted state, that is, the state that is an optimum solution to a problem posed by the environment. Lewontin, 1983. These critics claim that although adaptationism plays some important role in biology, it is not really all that central or ubiquitous. And indeed, we should try to balance it with other ways of thinking. I have been demonstrating, however, that it plays a crucial role in the analysis of every biological event at every scale from the creation of the first self-replicating macromolecule on up. If we gave up adaptationist reasoning, for instance, we would have to give up the best textbook argument for the very occurrence of evolution. I quoted Mark Ridley's version of it earlier. The widespread existence of homologies, those suspicious similarities of design that are not functionally necessary. Adaptationist reasoning is not optional. It is the heart and soul of evolutionary biology. Although it may be supplemented and its flaws repaired, to think of displacing it from central position in biology is to imagine not just the downfall of Darwinism, but the collapse of modern biochemistry and all the life sciences and medicine. So it is a bit surprising to discover that this is precisely the interpretation that many readers have placed on the most famous and influential critique of adaptationism, Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin's oft-cited, oft-reprinted, but massively misread classic, The Spandrels of San Marco, and The Panglossian Paradigm, A Critique of the Adaptationist Program, 1979. 2. The Leibnizian Paradigm. If among all the possible worlds none had been better than the rest, then God would never have created one. Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, 1710. The study of adaptation is not an optional preoccupation with fascinating fragments of natural history. It is the core of biological study. Colin Pittendrieg, 1958, page 395. Leibniz notoriously said that this was the best of all possible worlds, a striking suggestion that might seem preposterous from a distance, but turns out, as we have seen, to throw an interesting light on the deep questions of what it is to be a possible world, and on what we can infer about the actual world from the fact of its actuality. In Candide, Voltaire created a famous caricature of Leibniz, Dr. Pangloss, the learned fool who could rationalize any calamity or deformity, from the Lisbon earthquake to venereal disease, and show how, no doubt, it was all for the best. Nothing in principle could prove that this was not the best of all possible worlds. Gould and Lewontin memorably dubbed the excesses of adaptationism the Panglossian paradigm and strove to ridicule it off the stage of serious science. They were not the first to use Panglossian as a term of criticism in evolutionary theory. The evolutionary biologist J.B.S. Haldane had a famous list of three theorems of bad scientific argument. The Bellman's theorem, what I tell you three times is true, from The Hunting of the Snark by Lewis Carroll, Aunt Jobiska's theorem, It's a fact the whole world knows, from Edward Lear, the Pobble Who Had No Toes, and Pangloss's theorem, all is for the best in this best of all possible worlds, from Candide. John Maynard Smith then used the last of these, more particularly to name the old Panglossian fallacy that natural selection favors adaptations that are good for the species as a whole, rather than acting at the level of the individual. As he later commented, it is ironic that the phrase Pangloss's theorem was first used in the debate about evolution, in print, I think by myself, but borrowed from a remark of Haldane's, not as a criticism of adaptive explanations, but specifically as a criticism of group selectionist, mean fitness-maximizing arguments. Maynard Smith, 1988, page 88. But Maynard Smith is wrong, apparently. Gould has recently drawn attention to a still earlier use of the term by a biologist, William Bateson, 1909, of which he, Gould, had been unaware when he chose to use the term. As Gould, 1993A, page 312, says, the convergence is hardly surprising, as Dr. Pangloss is a standard synecdoche for this form of ridicule. As we talked about in Chapter 6, the more apt or fitting a brainchild is, the more likely it is to be born or borrowed independently in more than one brain. Voltaire created Pangloss as a parody of Leibniz, and it is exaggerated and unfair to Leibniz, as all good parody is. Gould and Lewontin similarly caricatured adaptationism in their article attacking it. So parody of reasoning suggests that, if we wanted to undo the damage of that caricature and describe adaptationism in an accurate and constructive way, we would have a title ready-made. We could call adaptationism fairly considered the Leibnizian paradigm. The Gould and Lewontin article has had a curious effect on the academic world. It is widely regarded by philosophers and other humanists who have heard of it or even read it as some sort of refutation of adaptationism. Indeed, I first learned of it from the philosopher-psychologist Jerry Fodor, a lifelong critic of my account of the intentional stance, who pointed out that what I was saying was pure adaptationism. He was right about that, and went on to let me in on what the cognoscenti all knew. Gould and Lewontin's article had shown adaptationism to be completely bankrupt. For an instance of Fodor's view in print, see Fodor, 1990, page 70. When I looked into it, I found out otherwise. In 1983, I published a paper in Behavioral and Brain Sciences, Intentional Systems in Cognitive Ethology. And since it was unabashedly adaptationist in its reasoning, I included a coda, The Pangloss's Paradigm Defended, which criticized both Gould and Lewontin's paper and, more particularly, the bizarre myth that had grown up around it. The results were fascinating. Every article that appears in BBS is accompanied by several dozen commentaries by experts in the relevant fields. And my piece drew fire from evolutionary biologists, psychologists, ethologists, and philosophers. Most of it friendly, but some remarkably hostile. One thing was clear, it was not just some philosophers and psychologists who were uncomfortable with adaptationist reasoning. In addition to the evolutionary theorists who weighed in enthusiastically on my side, Dawkins, 1983b, Maynard Smith, 1983, and those who fought back, Lewontin, 1983, there were those who, though they agreed with me that Gould and Lewontin had not refuted adaptationism, were eager to downplay the standard use of optimality assumptions that I claim to be an essential ingredient in all evolutionary thinking. Niles Eldridge, 1983, page 361, discussed the reverse engineering of functional morphologists. You will find sober analyses of fulcra, force vectors, and so forth. The understanding of anatomy as a living machine. Some of this stuff is very good. Some of it is absolutely dreadful. He went on to cite, as an example of good reverse engineering, the work of Dan Fisher, 1975, comparing modern horseshoe crabs with their Jurassic ancestors, assuming only that Jurassic horseshoe crabs also swam on their backs. Fisher showed they must have swum at an angle of 0 to 10 degrees, flat on their backs, and at the somewhat greater speed of 15 to 20 centimeters per second. Thus, the adaptive significance of the slight differences in anatomy between modern horseshoe crabs and their 150-million-year-old relatives is translated into an understanding of their slightly different swimming capabilities. In all honesty, I must also report that Fisher does use optimality in his arguments. He sees the differences between the two species as a sort of trade-off, where the slightly more efficient Jurassic swimmers appear to have used the same pieces of anatomy to burrow somewhat less efficiently than their modern-day relatives. In any case, Fisher's work stands as a really good example of functional morphological analysis. The notion of adaptation is naught but conceptual filigree, one that may have played a role in motivating the research, but one that was not vital to the research itself. Eldridge, 1983, page 362. But in fact, the role of optimality assumptions in Fisher's work, beyond the explicit role that Eldridge conceded, is so vital and indeed omnipresent that Eldridge entirely overlooked it. For instance, Fisher's inference that the Jurassic crabs swam at 15 to 20 centimeters per second has a tacit premise that those crabs swam at the optimal speed for their design. How does he know they swam at all? Perhaps they just lay there, oblivious of the excess functionality of their body shapes. Without this tacit, and of course dead obvious premise, no conclusion at all could be drawn about what the actual swimming speed of the Jurassic variety was. Michael Gesellin, 1983, page 363, was even more forthright in denying this unobvious, obvious dependence. Panglossianism is bad because it asks the wrong question, namely, what is good? The alternative is to reject such teleology altogether. Instead of asking what is good, we ask, what has happened? The new question does everything we could expect the old one to do, and a lot more besides. He was fooling himself. There is hardly a single answer to the question, what has happened in the biosphere, that doesn't depend crucially on assumptions about what is good. As we just noted, you can't even avail yourself of the concept of a homology without taking on adaptationism, without taking the intentional stance. So now what is the problem? It is the problem of how to tell good, irreplaceable adaptationism from bad adaptationism. How to tell Leibniz from Pangloss. Surely one reason for the extraordinary influence of Gould and Lewontin's paper among non-evolutionists is that it expressed, with many fine rhetorical flourishes, what Eldridge called the backlash against the concept of adaptationism among biologists. What were they reacting against? In the main, they were reacting against a certain sort of laziness. The adaptationist who hits upon a truly nifty explanation for why a particular circumstance should prevail, and then never bothers to test it, because it is too good a story, presumably not to be true. Adopting another literary label, this time from Rudyard Kipling, 1912, Gould and Lewontin call such explanations just-so stories. It is an enticing historical curiosity that Kipling wrote his just-so stories at a time when this objection to Darwinian explanation had already been swirling around for decades. Forms of it were raised by some of Darwin's earliest critics, Kitcher, 1985A, page 156. Was Kipling inspired by the controversy? In any case, calling the adaptationists' flights of imagination just-so stories hardly does them credit. As delightful as I have always found Kipling's fantasies about how the elephant got its trunk and the leopard got its spots, they are quite simple and unsurprising tales compared with the amazing hypotheses that have been concocted by adaptationists. Consider The Greater Honey Guide, Indicator Indicator, an African bird that owes its name to its talent for leading human beings to wild beehives hidden in the forest. When the Boran people of Kenya want to find honey, they call for the bird by blowing on whistles made of sculpted snail shells. When a bird arrives, it flies around them singing a special song, its follow me call. They follow as the bird darts ahead and waits for them to catch up, always making sure they can see where it's heading. When the bird reaches the hive, it changes its tune, giving the here we are call. When the Boran locate the beehive in the trunk and break into it, they take the honey, leaving wax and larva for the honey guide. Now, don't you ache to believe that this wonderful partnership actually exists and has the clever functional properties described? Don't you want to believe that such a marvel could have evolved under some imagined series of selection pressures and opportunities? I certainly do. And happily, in this case, the follow-up research is confirming the story, and even adding nifty touches as it does so. Recent controlled tests, for instance, show that the Boran honey hunters took much longer to find hives without the help of the birds, and 96% of the 186 hives found during the study were encased in trees in ways that would have made them inaccessible to the birds without human assistance. Isaac and Rayer, 1989. Another fascinating story which strikes closer to home is the hypothesis that our species, Homo sapiens, descended from earlier primates via an intermediate species that was aquatic. Hardy, 1960, Morgan, 1982, and 1990. These aquatic apes purportedly lived on the shores of an island formed by the flooding of the area that is now in Ethiopia, during the late Miocene, about 7 million years ago. Cut off by the flooding from their cousins on the African continent, and challenged by a relatively sudden change in their climate and food sources, they developed a taste for shellfish. And over a period of 1 million years or so, they began the evolutionary process of returning to the sea that we know was undergone earlier by whales, dolphins, seals, and otters, for instance. The process was well underway, leading to the fixation of many curious characteristics that are otherwise found only in aquatic mammals, not in any other primate, for example, when circumstances changed once again, and these semi-seagoing apes returned to a life on the land, but typically on the shore of sea, lake, or river. There they found that many of the adaptations they had developed for good reasons in their shell-diving days were not only not valuable, but a positive hindrance. They soon turned these handicaps to good uses, however, or at least made compensations for them. Their upright, bipedal posture, their subcutaneous layer of fat, their hairlessness, perspiration, tears, inability to respond to salt deprivation in standard mammalian ways, and of course, the diving reflex, which permits even newborn human infants to survive sudden submersion in water for long periods with no ill effects. The details, and there are many, many more, are so ingenious, and the whole aquatic ape theory is so shockingly anti-establishment that I, for one, would love to see it vindicated. That does not make it true, of course. The fact that its principal exponent these days is not only a woman, Elaine Morgan, but an amateur, a science writer without proper official credentials in spite of her substantial researches, makes the prospect of vindication all the more enticing. The establishment has responded quite ferociously to her challenges, mostly treating them as beneath notice, but occasionally subjecting them to withering rebuttal. This is not necessarily a pathological reaction. Most uncredentialed proponents of scientific revolutions are kooks who really are not worth paying any attention to. There really are a lot of them besieging us, and life is too short to give each uninvited hypothesis its proper day in court. But in this case, I wonder. Many of the counterarguments seem awfully thin and ad hoc. During the last few years, when I have found myself in the company of distinguished biologists, evolutionary theorists, paleoanthropologists, and other experts, I have often asked them just to tell me, please, exactly why Elaine Morgan must be wrong about the aquatic ape theory. I haven't yet had a reply worth mentioning, aside from those who admit, with a twinkle in their eyes, that they have often wondered the same thing. There seems to be nothing inherently impossible about the idea. Other mammals have made the plunge after all. Why couldn't our ancestors have started back into the ocean and then retreated, bearing some telltale scars of this history? Morgan may be accused of telling a good story. She certainly has. But not of declining to try to test it. On the contrary, she has used the story as leverage to coax a host of surprising predictions out of a variety of fields, and has been willing to adjust her theory when the results have demanded it. Otherwise, she has stuck to her guns and, in fact, invited attack on her views through the vehemence of her partisanship. As so often happens in such a confrontation, the intransigence and defensiveness on both sides have begun to take their toll, creating one of those spectacles that then discourage anyone who just wants to know the truth from having anything more to do with the subject. Morgan's latest book on the topic, 1990, responded with admirable clarity, however, to the objections that had been lodged to date, and usefully contrasted the strengths and weaknesses of the aquatic ape theory to those of the establishment's history. And more recently still, a book has appeared that collects essays by a variety of experts for and against the aquatic ape theory. Rode and others, 1991. The tentative verdict of the organizers of the 1987 conference from which that book sprang, page 324, is that while there are a number of arguments favoring the AAT, they are not sufficiently convincing to counteract the arguments against it. That judicious note of mild disparagement helps ensure that the argument will continue, perhaps even with less rancor. It will be interesting to see where it all comes out. My point in raising the aquatic ape theory is not to defend it against the establishment view, but to use it as an illustration of a deeper worry. Many biologists would like to say, a pox on both your houses. Morgan, 1990, deftly exposes the hand-waving and wishful thinking that have gone into the establishment's tale about how, and why, Homo sapiens developed bipedalism, sweating, and hairlessness on the savanna, not the seashore. Their stories may not be literally as fishy as hers, but some of them are pretty far-fetched. They are every bit as speculative and, I venture to say, no better confirmed. What they mainly have going for them, so far as I can see, is that they occupied the high ground in the textbooks before Hardy and Morgan tried to dislodge them. Both sides are indulging in adaptationist just-so stories, and since some story or other must be true, we must not conclude we have found the story just because we have come up with a story that seems to fit the facts. To the extent that adaptationists have been less than energetic in seeking further confirmation, or dreaded disconfirmation, of their stories, this is certainly an excess that deserves criticism. But before leaving it at that, I want to point out that there are many adaptationist stories that everybody is happy to accept, even though they have never been properly tested, just because they are too obviously true to be worth further testing. Does anybody seriously doubt that eyelids evolved to protect the eye? But that very obviousness may hide good research questions from us. George Williams points out that concealed behind such obvious facts may lie others that are well worth further investigation. A human eye blink takes about 50 milliseconds. That means that we are blind about 5% of the time when we are using our eyes normally. Many events of importance can happen in 50 milliseconds, so that we might miss them entirely. A rock or spear thrown by a powerful adversary can travel more than a meter in 50 milliseconds, and it could be important to perceive such motion as accurately as possible. Why do we blink with both eyes simultaneously? Why not alternate and replace 95% visual attentiveness with 100%? I can imagine an answer in some sort of trade-off balance. A blink mechanism for both eyes at once may be much simpler and cheaper than one that regularly alternates. G. Williams, 1992, pages 152 to 53. Williams has not himself yet attempted to confirm or disconfirm any hypothesis growing out of this exemplary piece of adaptationist problem setting. But he has called for the research by asking the question. It would be as pure an exercise in reverse engineering as can be imagined. Serious consideration of why natural selection permits simultaneous blinking might yield otherwise elusive insights. What change in the machinery would be needed to produce the first step towards my envisioned adaptive alternation or simple independent timing? How might the change be achieved developmentally? What other changes would be expected from a mutation that produced a slight lag in the blinking of one eye? How would selection act on such a mutation? G. Williams, 1992, page 153. Gould himself has endorsed some of the most daring and delicious of adaptationist just-so stories, such as the argument by Lloyd and Dibas, 1966, explaining why cicadas, such as 17-year locusts, have reproductive cycles that are prime-numbered years long, 13 years or 17, but never 15 or 16, for instance. As evolutionists, Gould says, we seek answers to the question why. Why, in particular, should such striking synchronicity evolve? And why should the period between episodes of sexual reproduction be so long? Gould, 1977A, page 99. The answer, which makes beautiful sense in retrospect, is that by having a large prime number of years between appearances, the cicadas minimize the likelihood of being discovered and later tracked as a predictable feast by predators who themselves show up every 2 years or 3 years or 5 years. If the cicadas had a periodicity of, say, 16 years, then they would be a rare treat for predators who showed up every year, but a more reliable source of food for predators who showed up every 2 or 4 years, and an even money gamble for predators that got in phase with them on an 8-year schedule. If their period is not a multiple of any lower number, however, they are a rare treat, not worth trying to track, for any species that isn't lucky enough to have exactly their periodicity, or some multiple of it. The mythical 34-year locust muncher would be in Fat City. I don't know whether Lloyd and Dibas's just-so story has been properly confirmed yet, but I don't think Gould is guilty of Panglossianism in treating it as established until proven otherwise. And if he really wants to ask and answer why questions, he has no choice but to be an adaptationist. The problem he and Lewontin perceive is that there are no standards for when a particular bit of adaptationist reasoning is too much of a good thing. How serious, really, is this problem even if it has no principled solution? Darwin has taught us not to look for essences, for dividing lines between genuine function or genuine intentionality and mere on-its-way-to-being function or intentionality. We commit a fundamental error if we think, if we want to indulge in adaptationist thinking, we need a license, and the only license could be the possession of a strict definition of or criterion for a genuine adaptation. There are good rules of thumb to be followed by the prospective reverse engineer, made explicit years ago by George Williams, 1966. 1. Don't invoke adaptation when other lower-level explanations are available, such as physics. We don't have to ask what advantage accrues to maple trees that explains the tendency of their leaves to fall down, any more than the reverse engineers at Raytheon need to hunt for a reason why GE made their widgets so that they would melt readily in blast furnaces. 2. Don't invoke adaptation when a feature is the outcome of some general developmental requirement. We don't need a special reason of increased fitness to explain the fact that heads are attached to bodies, or limbs come in pairs, any more than the people at Raytheon need to explain why the parts in GE's widget have so many edges and corners with right angles. 3. Don't invoke adaptation when a feature is a byproduct of another adaptation. We don't need to give an adaptationist explanation of the capacity of a bird's beak to groom its feathers, since the features of the bird's beak are there for more pressing reasons, any more than we need a special explanation of the capacity of GE widget's casing to shield the innards from ultraviolet rays. But you will already have noticed that in each case these rules of thumb can be overridden by a more ambitious inquiry. Suppose someone marveling at the brilliant autumn foliage in New England asks why the maple leaves are so vividly colored in October. Isn't this adaptationism run amok? Shades of Dr. Pangloss. The leaves are the colors they are simply because once the summer energy harvest season is over, the chlorophyll vanishes from the leaves, and the residual molecules have reflective properties that happen to determine the bright colors. An explanation at the level of chemistry or physics, not biological purpose. But wait. Although this may have been the only explanation that was true up until now, today it is true that human beings so prize the autumn foliage, it brings millions of tourist dollars to northern New England each year, that they protect the trees that are brightest in autumn. You can be sure that if you are a tree competing for life in New England, there is now a selective advantage to having bright autumn foliage. It may be tiny, and in the long run it may never amount to much. In the long run there may be no trees at all in New England, for one reason or another. But this is how all adaptations get their start, after all. As fortuitous effects that get opportunistically picked up by selective forces in the environment. And of course, there is also an adaptationist explanation for why right angles predominate in manufactured goods, and why symmetry predominates in organic limb manufacturing. These may become utterly fixed traditions, which would be almost impossible to dislodge by innovation, but the reasons why these are the traditions are not hard to find. Or controversial. Adaptationist research always leaves unanswered questions open for the next round. Consider the leatherback sea turtle and her eggs. Near the end of egg laying, a variable number of small, sometimes misshapen eggs, containing neither embryo nor yolk, just albumen, are deposited. Their purpose is not well understood, but they become desiccated over the course of incubation and may moderate humidity or air volume in the incubation chamber. It is also possible that they have no function or are a vestige of some past mechanisms not apparent to us today. Eckert, 1992, page 30. But where does it all end? Such open-endedness of adaptationist curiosity is unnerving to many theorists, apparently, who wish there could be stricter codes of conduct for this part of science. Many who have hoped to contribute to clearing up the controversy over adaptationism and its backlash have despaired of finding such codes after much energy has been expended in drawing up and criticizing various legislative regimes. They are just not being Darwinian enough in their thinking. Better adaptationist thinking soon drives out its rivals by normal channels, just as second-rate reverse engineering betrays itself sooner or later. The Eskimo face, once depicted as cold-engineered, Kuhn et al., 1950, becomes an adaptation to generate and withstand large masticatory forces, Shea, 1977. We do not attack these newer interpretations. They may all be right. We do wonder, though, whether the failure of one adaptive explanation should always simply inspire a search for another of the same general form, rather than a consideration of alternatives to the proposition that each part is for some specific purpose. Gould and Lewontin, 1979, page 152. Is the rise and fall of successive adaptive explanations of various things a sign of healthy science constantly improving its vision? Or is it like the pathological story shifting of the compulsive fibber? If Gould and Lewontin had a serious alternative to adaptationism to offer, their case for the latter verdict would be more persuasive. But although they and others have hunted around energetically and promoted their alternatives boldly, none has yet taken root. Adaptationism, the paradigm that views organisms as complex adaptive machines whose parts have adaptive functions subsidiary to the fitness-promoting function of the whole, is today about as basic to biology as the atomic theory is to chemistry, and about as controversial. Explicitly adaptationist approaches are ascendant in the sciences of ecology, ethology, and evolution because they have proven essential to discovery. If you doubt this claim, look at the journals. Gould and Lewontin's call for an alternative paradigm has failed to impress practicing biologists, both because adaptationism is successful and well-founded, and because its critics have no alternative research program to offer. Each year sees the establishment of such new journals as Functional Biology and Behavioral Ecology. Sufficient research to fill a first issue of Dialectical Biology has yet to materialize. Daily, 1991, page 219. What particularly infuriates Gould and Lewontin, as the passage about the Eskimo face suggests, is the blithe confidence with which adaptationists go about their reverse engineering, always sure that sooner or later they will find the reason why things are as they are, even if it so far eludes them.